All right, guys. Thank you to another episode. Thank you for joining us for another episode of South Sudan and the World. As we say in this show, we meet South Sudanese changing the world and people around the world changing South Sudan. Today, we have a very special guest who has an inspiring story, Joseph Dudi Mebuk. He was a refugee, and now he's an Ivy League graduate. This is a story of inspiration and a story that needs to be told. So, welcome to the show, Brother Joseph. How are you doing?
I am doing great, Akol. Thank you so much for having me and for the very nice introduction.
That's good. That's good. I see that you're adjusting to the cold coming from Africa, going to that American cold. How has that been?
Oh, my days. I think we can talk about this for days and days, you know, on and on. But I don't think my body is ever going to fully adjust to the weather, especially in the Northeast. I'm currently in Rochester, and it was snowing the other day. So one thing I've learned is like what people say, you know, like it's not about the weather; it's about how you dress, right? So I'm trying to see like how can I dress better every time, and I always get cold. So,
and you have layers and layers.
Yeah.
A jacket on top of a jacket, a hat, gloves.
Oh, okay. That's a lot. So you know, like when I came, this is an interesting story. When I came to the U.S. and then I had a host family and they brought me the layers, right? And the layers, like, think about it. If you come from the continent, right, especially in the hot places, they look like those like skin tight thingy for women to sort of like work out and stuff, yeah. Right? And they brought that to me. And I looked at it and I was like, what am I supposed to do with it? I wasn't gonna be rude and say like I'm not gonna wear it, but I did not wear it. Guess what? 3 or 4 years down the line, I'm the one buying them now.
Yeah, because you thought maybe, okay, this is crazy, but then you found out you're the crazy one because you're like, wait, they're wearing it, what's the problem with me?
Exactly. Yeah.
So, Joseph, you have an interesting story. You were a refugee, and then you went to Harvard. People ask, how did you get into Harvard? How was that experience like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was surreal, like, and a lot. Everything happened so fast and slow at the same time. Yeah, it happened so fast and slow at the same time. But, yeah, I lived in Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya for about 15 years, actually. Yeah, 15 years. And then I graduated from high school, right? And I did well. So in Kakuma, there are some scholarships, right? Like the WUSC, which has taken a lot of students from the camp to Canada. And then there is, you know, Duffy and everything. So I did try to apply for those, but for some reason, they wouldn't take me. I wouldn't even go past the English language test of the program, leave alone going for the oral interview. And I was like, this has to be insane because it just didn't speak right to me. But anyway, things happen, right? And then there was this program in Rwanda called Bridge to Rwanda, and they decided they were going to take refugees, right? And so they came in to interview us, and I did the interview, I did the TOEFL, the oral, and then they picked us, one, me and another lady, so we were the first people to go to Bridge to Rwanda. So Bridge to Rwanda is also a college prep program, so, you know, you've done the college application process in the U.S., so, and you know how difficult it is with the Common App and, like, essays and whatnot, and the standardized exams. So for us, it's more difficult if you're from outside the U.S. So Bridge Rwanda sort of like makes it easy to do all this prep. And so I was in Bridge Rwanda and we did all this process. And then, you know, applied to various schools and Harvard was one of them. And yeah, I think that's the long story of how it happened. There's like a lot of other small details in, you know, there. But I think that's like the overview of the whole, you know, the journey.
Okay. Now, you said you spent 15 years in Kakuma refugee camp. How was your upbringing like? What was your life like in primary school and secondary school?
Oh yeah. It's crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. I remember, so we began, you know, I began schooling, you know, back in the days, and it was I lived in Kakuma 3. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Kakuma, but if anyone is familiar with Kakuma, they will know this. I lived in Kakuma 3. A lot of my friends, you know, from the internet, like, we just bump into each other and like, I knew you from Kakuma 3. So I lived in Kakuma 3. We started out schooling. There weren't like a lot of classrooms, right? So my classroom was actually under the tree. And the church was not even built. The church was like in the open, like the Don Bosco, like the San Kombone Catholic Church, right? And my class was just right by. And so I remember, like, the first day I went to school, they said I go to nursery school. I didn't, like, I refused because they said, like, I wasn't ready. So I had to do P1 twice because by the time I graduated, I couldn't reach my other ear, and they were like, that's the test for the age, right? So that's where it all began. I repeated it, yeah.
And you ended up going to Harvard. Listen,
yeah.
You face any challenge when you're young. You keep going. You keep overcoming. I mean, Joseph just told us he repeated P1.
Don't listen to them. Don't listen to them. Just do your way. Like, it's going to work out.
Path. Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. So they told me, like, you cannot go to P2 because you're not old enough, because I couldn't reach, like, my arm couldn't reach my other ear. Like, I don't know if you know about that test. It's like an age test. And I was like, that's not cool. So my friends went, I was left, and I was like, fine. Yeah, so that's where we began. And then I did my studies in the camp up to P6. And then I remember, like, because of the situation in the camp around the 2007-2008, we went to Nairobi, enrolled in Mwiki Primary School, where I did my KCPE. I don't know if you're familiar with these terms. And then because...
Explain it to our viewers.
Oh, okay, yeah. They may not be... It's like eighth grade.
Okay.
All right, eighth grade. So there's like a national exam for eighth grade, and there's also a national exam for 12th grade. So after that, because I was in a public school, so obviously, like, not paying anything. It's free in Kenya. So after that, high school is not free, right? And I couldn't go to high school, so I went back to the camp. Started out in my ninth grade. And we used to go to school at, you know, like, the school session starts at around 7:40 a.m. And then we would, like, 1:40 p.m., like, we're out. So that was, like, half day, when everybody else is, like, learning, you know, full day, like, I think from 8 to 4. And so there was that. I started there, and then I remember having to walk for, like, 45 minutes. I was a little bit young, so I was like, I think I was the youngest in my class, so I'm, like, the teeny tiny. I mean, most of the people in the class were adults, but because of the refugee setting and whatnot. But I think I was, like, one of the youngest, if not the youngest. But I had to walk for, like, 45 minutes in the scorching heat, and that was unbearable sometimes. Like, every day, Monday through Friday, it didn't matter whether it rained or shine. Like, it's just, I had to do it every day. I like school, but, like, in that setting, bro, like, it's a different setting. Like, sometimes it's like sandy storms, and then you wouldn't be taught in class, or, like, it's just so hot. And the teacher says, like, all right, let's just skip this and stuff. So yeah, I did that. I think in high school, I ended up going to 5 schools before I graduated, which is crazy, because it was almost like every school, like, the next school I would go to would be an upgrade of the school that I was in. So I had to, like, play a lot of catch up, which was great in some way.
Were you in the refugee camp?
No, I was not. I was not. I was born in South Sudan. I was born in Ruweng, right, in Pariang. Not exactly Pariang, but yeah, I was born there.
And yeah. When did you go to a refugee camp? Do you remember going to a refugee camp?
2002. I recall it. It was yeah.
Okay.
It was 2002, yeah. And 2002. Yeah, I actually went with my aunt, not my parents. And that's because the 2002, it was a little bit chaotic in Ruang, and there was like a lot of this fighting going on. So in the process, I was separated from my parents and ended up with my aunt. And we got airlifted to Lokichogyo and eventually ended up settling in Kakuma.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the other part of the story.
So you ended up in a refugee camp.
Yes. And
what was your first reaction like when you saw your acceptance letter to Harvard? First of all, what made you want to apply to Harvard? That's so bold.
You're a refugee. I know.
You so, have all these circumstances and you apply to Harvard. That's.
I think that's a reason. There. I think that's a reason enough to apply. Because, like, I mean, why not? Right. Initially, I had my eyes set on Stanford, right? And Stanford. But it didn't work for ED. Kind of like broke me a little bit, but, and I was like, all right, y'all said no. So let's go for
They said no, Stanford rejected.
Yeah, they said no, yeah. And I was like,
Stanford,
yeah.
Are you guys hearing this?
And they said no. And I was like, all right, let's try.
So
yeah.
The Bridge to Rwanda program supported you during your university?
They supported me before I did apply for university. I think Harvard actually takes good care of their students. Shout out to Harvard. Yeah, so it was like, yeah. I actually found out when I was in the U.S. that I got into Harvard, right? So there is this scholarship program at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. So they actually fly in students for this interview, like for this like prestigious, it's a prestigious scholarship, I should say. And so on the last day of the interview process, and I was going to fly out the following day back to Rwanda. That's when I found out. So I logged in into this huge computer in one of the libraries. And there it was. I was in suits. Like I was like suited up because I just came from the dinner and then like went straight to just go and check it. And as I don't know, I don't know how to describe that feeling. Because mm-hmm. It was like everything just paid off.
You were very happy. Now
very excited. Yeah.
What was your first time like at Harvard?
Oh yes.
Getting on the plane and going.
Oh yeah, it was.
Was there a culture shock?
A lot of it. So I came in the summer, August, right? And I didn't have a phone, and like everything is like crimson, like brownish, right? All the buildings, so they sort of like looked the same to me. So on the first day, I came. The person who was supposed to pick me up at the airport, like we didn't, because I didn't have a phone, we couldn't communicate, and they ended up at the wrong terminal than like the one I was, you know, the one I landed in. Luckily, I had like a $50 note that like I just found a taxi guy, and I was like, take me to the Harvard like yard, right? And it was supposed, with Uber, it could have been like $20, $25 at the time, but he just took my $50, which was like the only money I had. And like I was super excited but tired at the same time, and I was just like, he dropped me at the gate, so I had to find my way around with all those like crimson buildings. But so I was relieved to be on campus. But you see like how people dress here, like in the summer, right? Since I went to ninth grade, I hadn't worn a short before, right? It was always gonna be pants, long pants. It didn't matter like how hot it is, right? And like just to cover myself and things like, you know, like how people dress like right back on the continent. So I come, it is the summer, and you know how people dress here, guys in shorts, like super super short, like it's the same for everyone. And I look at it. I have read all these things. I have seen movies about these things, but it's like, it wasn't just settling in. Like, is everything good on your end?
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you.
Oh, okay. So I looked at everyone. I'm like, what is going on? Is it like a special day? Like, have you heard about the nudity week in Brown?
I don't know about that. There's a nudity.
Oh my days. Yeah, it's. I think it's like this week they do the exam and like everybody just. There are videos out there on the internet, so just go check it for yourself. But I was like, is it one of those days? But it's just like a casual, you know, day. It's hot and people need to loosen up. So at that time, it was a big deal.
So you went there and that happened. So what was it like at Harvard as a South Sudanese? Were there other South Sudanese there with you? Was there other Africans? And how did you overcome some of your challenges?
Yeah, I was lucky enough because Tito was there. Tito Yak, should be a familiar name with Kenya, with South Sudanese, especially those who were in Kenya, because he did exceptional well, especially in the eighth grade national exams, right? Just like the other girl that was like number four nationally, that was actually Tito during his time. Mm-hmm. So Tito was there. The freshmen are a little bit in their own community relative to upperclassmen. So we didn't really get to like hang out that much during my first year. And that also has to do with just, there's a lot of work to do, right? And there's a lot of work to do. Yeah. But as someone who grew up in Kenya, I could, you know, I related with a lot of Kenyans, right? And there's a good population of Kenyans at Harvard, like, you know, well represented, right? And so we had that. But when you are in a multicultural setting like Harvard, yes, it's good to have your own people, but it's also good to sort of like venture out and learn about other people, their cultures, their upbringings, and sort of like, you know, just appreciate the diversity of everything, right? Mm-hmm. So I sort of like had like, so I think what I figured out is like you get different things from different people. Like if I wanted to feel a sense of like home and talk things about growing up that are very similar, I would mostly be with my East African friends. Mm-hmm. But there's also like other things. Like if I wanted to talk about a specific genre of writing or like of whatever, like I knew the people to talk to about that. So it's just different people gave me a little bit of everything. So I sort of like found my community in that sense. Talking about challenges, there's like a lot of challenges, but every day you learn to navigate those and to, you know, overcome them. Yeah, like simple things like it took me time to realize like it's okay to go to office hours, right? Talk to your professors. Like if you don't understand anything, just they will explain to you. Where I come from, it's like you gotta do it on your own, and then like see the final result, right? So those like it just takes time.
People don't get that.
They don't get that. Yeah.
School, they really encourage you. They give you the resources.
Yeah.
Ensure that you succeed because you have office hours, you have TAs, you have a list of things that you have resources access to that you need to capitalize on. And if you say I'm gonna do it my way, and it's a culture thing where. Your way, it's okay. But also, if you don't know something, just say I don't know, because you're in an academic setting, you're in a learning setting, you're there to learn. Learning means you don't know, and there's experts
you don't know. That can make sense of. Yeah, for us, there needs to be some sort of like culture shift, and I think it's ingrained in us in school, right? Because that's what a school teaches you. Like back, like at least in my experience in Kenya, that's what like school teaches you, and there's also like. There was never a world where I could imagine talking to my professors about a show that I watched or, you know, just football or just some random thing or just like exchanging jokes, right? But in college, it's like it happens and it's a normal thing, right? And now if I recall it now, it's like, the teachers the professors that, or like the TAs and the people that we actually got to know each other, like personally outside academics, are the people I'm in touch with. And like, the academic, like, just like, it was that setting. It was like, okay, let's figure it out. It's solved. So what? Go your way. I go my way. So it's a huge culture shift, and it takes time to get adjusted to that. And it can be a challenge if you're not, like, if you don't figure that out, like, early on. Like, it can take a toll on you if you just want to, like, be like, okay, I'm gonna do it, and I'm not gonna go and ask for help. Like, yeah, it can be a challenge for your studies.
You grow. I mean, so, like, why did you pick your major? I mean, history and science. That's a very interesting major. It's a very unique major.
It's unique, yeah, and very interesting.
What was your thought process when you wanted to select your major?
So my thought process has been, it goes back to, like, where I come from, South Sudan. By the time I was applying, I think the literacy rates in South Sudan was around, like, 27%. And that's shocking. It was the lowest in the world, and I think it still is. And so in my mind, I'm like, we have this emerging technology, right? Like, it has so much power and capacity, right? So in my mind, I was like, we have a new nation, right? And in some way, I want to contribute to it. Like, I want us to know peace, right? Like, if there's anything I ever talk about, I don't want kids going through the experience that I and my colleagues went through, not just in South Sudan, but, like, all over the world. And if we needed to stabilize our country, we have to, you know, have this knowledge-based economy, right? And how do you do, like, how do you get your population to be knowledgeable? It's South Sudan, like, more than 75% of the people are young adults, right? And this is a lot of potential. It's skills. Like, if they're empowered, then, like, they can drive the economy. And hopefully that contributes to a space, like, it gives us a space where we can enjoy peace, you know, and just not be in all this war. So I was like, the technology we have, how do we use that power to deliver, like, high quality, you know, knowledge, but also, like, making it accessible to more and more people in South Sudan. And so that is what my goal has always been. It still is my goal, right? So how do we use that? And initially, I didn't know about any major. So I was like, I'm going to do computer science. And then after computer science, probably do a master's. That is because, like, there wasn't a specific program tailored to what I was trying to achieve. So unless I do computer science and then, you know, go for the master's or probably the PhD or whatever. But, and I wasn't going to do computer science because I wanted to be a software developer or, like, you know, be at a computer level. No, I think it's just, that wasn't me. And then I had heard about the program, but not from, like, the technology perspective, right? And then later on, I found out about it, right? So what it does, my specific concentration, right? There's a focus of this major. It's science, technology. I think it's technology, information, and society. And it's just the connection between this, right? Like, something usually happens in the society and it needs being solved. And once it is solved, you come up, like, with a new technology. Now, this new technology actually shapes society in a different way. Let's think about it. You know, with fire, right? Everyone was just like, okay, we're out there. And then, like, there was fire. And then when fire happened, it was like, that's a new technology. Now, how was it going to affect us? Now we could cook our food. So, you know, like, we could dry our food and store it for long term. So we didn't need, like, we could, you know, get our food and, like, smoke it. And we knew for the next 2-3 days we had food. But initially we couldn't do that because it was going to go bad. So that changed our habits, right? And then the domestication process began. It's if you want to look at other technologies, like, say, military warfare, right? Like, in the beginning, if you wanted to fight someone, it had to be hand-to-hand combat. Right? It had to be hand-to-hand combat. And it was difficult, right? There was like, there's a lot of feelings involved and everything if you wanted to defeat your enemy. But as we speak, like, all you need to do is be at a computer and with a drone somewhere, I don't know, in a desert. Yeah, and you just press a button and you're going to do more damage than you would have done with a single punch. So it's that shift in technology from where it started with like hand-to-hand combat to, you know, where like you just need a computer and then like it doesn't even feel like you're dealing with human beings. It's just like a video game. So it's that. That's what my focus, that's what my major is actually about, like these technological changes and how they shape society. And I felt like that's,
did you enjoy the major and what were some things?
It was awesome. It was awesome.
I liked it a lot.
Oh my God, I loved it. I love it. It was great. It was
the best. Do you plan to pursue a master's?
Yes, I do. In fact, I was supposed to start one this last September, but then I was like, all my life, it's always been like.
At Harvard too?
No, not Harvard. I was like, all my life, it's just like, it's either I'm in a school or I'm trying to go into school. Right. Okay. And I was like, I think that's more to me than that. So let's sort of like be out there for a while and then see if I actually still want to go back or how long I want to be out there before I go
school
back. But I think
training.
It is, yeah.
And it's one thing, that's why I really applaud people and I find somebody that has a master's, a PhD, you got to give it to them, man. It takes a lot, man, because you have to stop your life to just study.
To just study, yeah.
And you just,
I mean,
it's good, but it's like you can't, and especially now with some of these academic fields, it's hard to be like, oh,
yeah,
I'm gonna work part-time, go to school. You literally have to stop and do this.
You just have to stop. I mean, yeah.
So some of the things that you've done, and I was going to say, is you are a digital media consultant. You are outreach website manager for the African, the Harvard University Center for African Studies. You done coding, and now you're co-founder of an organization.
Yes.
Tell us about that. I mean, you founded Elimisha Kakuma to train refugees to apply for scholarships. So you're giving back. So the opportunity you got, you're really giving it back to them.
Yes. That's the whole idea. So I think every time I look at our students, I see my young self, right? Just in Kakuma, fresh out of high school, very enthusiastic about the world, right? And the prospects ahead. And when I graduated, I didn't have the opportunity right away, right? To just go to college. Because of the financial burden, but also like because of the settings, right? Because of where I came from as a refugee, we have this limited opportunity. So what ended up happening is like, by the time I was beginning my freshman year, my colleagues were graduating from high school. From college, right? By the time I was finishing my freshman year in college, my friends were graduating from college. And the reason is because like they didn't have to take these unnecessary gaps, right? And so there's a lot of bright students in Kakuma that actually graduate with good grades and don't end up going to college. And the reason is just the resources and the finances, right, to pursue an education. And so they end up taking like 2, 3, 4 gap years before they can go back to school. And for others, they never go back to school because like they don't have that chance, right? So we wanted, because it worked for us, we looked back and we were like, this is something we can also do for people in our situation, right? And to just, so the thing is, it's actually a ripple effect, because in that sense, like if you have this refugee student and then like you equip them with the necessary resources to compete for positions and scholarships in the US or Canada or Europe. And once they have it, like once they have that it opens up a new sort of like new horizon, a new world for them, but not just for them, but also like for their immediate families, right? They can take their siblings to school, like they can, you know, just a better life for their family. So this is what we try to do to advocate for refugee students and for them, because the campus, like you go in there and you're trapped. Like there's no way out. Like I know of people that went into the camp before I did, and they're still there. Like some of them have had kids, right? And some of them.
What's stopping them from leaving the camp?
Because the campus. So first of all, right, you come in as a refugee, like with all those. I think trauma is a little bit underrated, like in our communities. But going to the camp, especially those who went in the 90s, it's accompanied with a lot of trauma, and they lost their homes and they settled there. So that is like their homes. The camp is like their home. But the problem is, once you're in the camp, there are basically almost no opportunities, right, to grow as a person, you know, professionally, you know, economically. Like, you look at it from any angle, like, it's just, you're stifled, like, right? Everything is provided for you free, but rationed. Like, it's not enough for you to thrive, but it's enough to keep you going. Right. And because of that, and there's also limit, like you can't really get out of the camp and do business if you have the resources to do that because of the restrictions from the Kenyan government. Right. And there's also like the security, like you're not allowed to leave the camp. You have to get like all these permits. And most of the time they're going to say, no, they're not going to. Yes, you can't.
And that's.
That's insane. It's yeah.
I mean, what if somebody wants to leave the camp? They can't come back?
The camp is a quasi prison. No, coming back is not like coming back is. Coming back also, like, you're going to get. If the police catches you, you know, they're going to do stuff and stuff, but like, you're going to get in. But going out as a refugee is the issue. You have to have like a special permit to leave, and it's hard to get that permit. And even if you have it, it has like so many, it has limit. It's like probably like for 3 months, and they put like a travel document. And then if you get arrested outside the camp by the police, you're in trouble. A lot of trouble, actually. So the camp is, in a way, it was supposed to be temporary, just like housing, you know, refugees for a while, you know, they find a pathway to wherever, I don't know, maybe a third country or repatriation, or maybe integrating into the communities in those countries. But it's actually now a permanent camp. It's a town by itself. It's now a thriving town, and it's just like you're in. Like it's that difficult to get out.
Oh wow!
Yeah,
so that's really so. I mean, this is why you see a lot of people. You hear they've been there 15 years, 20 years. Etc.
Yes,
it's tough. And it really impacts a lot of students, because, you know, there's so many brilliant South Sudanese. I mean, like you said, people like yourself, people like Tito Yak. But how many Josephs and Tito Yaks are out there that haven't been supported and empowered? And that's the question we have to ask. And how many brilliant young boys and girls are we really marginalizing and disadvantaging because they don't have opportunities? And this is a common thing. I even grew up in the U.S. There's people who are really brilliant who didn't get opportunities to go to school. So really applaud that you did this, to the idea of a scholarship fund, the idea of trying to help them find funding and targeting people who are disadvantaged. I mean, it truly is. And so for you now, what is your career trajectory looking like? Where do you see yourself in the next 3 to 4 years?
Oh my God. I think that's a question you shouldn't ask a fresh college graduate. You're sending me into this existential crisis now. How is my career trajectory like? So I think there's a lot of learning in the process, right? Especially in America. I think when I first got into school, I really never thought about like the job market and the skills that are like required for it. I was more like I told you before, like I was like, okay, undergrad, grad school, right? And then now I'm like, let's put it to a pause, right? So I have my plans, but I would hesitate to sort of like be like, okay, this is the definite thing that I'm going to do, because there's a lot of, I think there's like more things to consider. And as time goes by, we'll see what happens. But I think I will be back in a school in either like next year or the year after.
Okay.
That is solid. Schools?
You want to go back to Harvard or you?
No, not now. I think I want, Harvard is great. It's amazing. But, you know, I had my experience at Harvard, right? And there's a lot more out there that I could also learn, you know, from a different school. Right. So I'm not ruling out the option of going back to Harvard, but I think right now I would rather prioritize like an experience elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. I mean, that's good and that's fair because you've already experienced it. I mean, what new you're going to get if you go back to Harvard? If you go to another school, you get different experiences, different exposure, different networks. And it's fair. I mean, many people, they opt out from self-matriculating because they believe, well, college is an experience. So if you've already gotten some experience, and also it's good to have something new.
If
you continue there, that means you have done your bachelor's and your master's. Some people don't have no problem with that, but then also there's another group of people.
Yeah.
You got to get different experiences there.
I mean, like, I realized.
Get into Stanford.
Yeah, they have some interesting programs that I'd be interested in. But anyway, that's for later. So one thing I realized is, like, just being at Harvard is, like, yes, I have been in America. But the more I continue to engage with other people, the more I actually just realize Harvard is a pretty much exclusive sort of, like, isolated place in the U.S. So sometimes, like, some things is just like just Harvard only, right? It doesn't apply to the U.S. Like, it's just that place with those people, and it's like, I don't know if it's the same for any other college campus, but what I do realize is like it was like, you know, in that space, like it's a little bit different from other spaces.
Yeah. I mean, but also you have to consider, I mean, Harvard is by far the best school in the world, and it's seen it. It's very elitist. Think about the people who've gone to Harvard. Obama, a whole list of people, the whole Ivy League.
Yeah.
So when you come from Africa to Harvard, you're in a whole different ecosystem. And then the ecosystem you're in now is just, when you step out of it, then you're like, okay, this is a whole nother world. Most college towns or college campuses are built in a way to insulate people in the campus. Like everything you go, there's a sporting events, there's a campus library, there's a restaurant, everything just is around the campus. So you can spend a whole year in college and not knowing what's going on outside of the world because you're just insulated with the college campus environment. And it happens to the best of us. I mean, it's just part of it. I mean, it's truly a blessing. I mean, you count your blessing, be able to go from a refugee camp to the best university in the world. I mean, people consider refugee camps one of the worst places that you could be, right? And
it is, yeah.
So you went from, you went from one of the worst places to the best.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's like a whole 180 change, which is, I mean, that's truly a blessing. So, but now for you in your future, what do you think, how can you apply your degree in South Sudan? How can you share your ideas that can make South Sudan a better place?
Going back to the previous conversation we had, I think one of the things I miss about Harvard right now, and this could potentially be one of the reasons that I go back, is just the people you find, but also like the day-to-day conversations. Like, anytime I talked with my colleagues, it's just like, I felt like I learned a lot from what they say, from their work, from how they speak. It's just like, even at lunch, there's a little bit of that, but sort of like in in non-academic setting or like outside now that in this non-academic setting, it's like one of the things that I miss. Anyway, going back to South Sudan, like I said before, I'm looking at, you know, and generally like in with people in who have been disadvantaged in a lot of ways, especially with like conflict induced migration, so like forced migration, is so these are people who have been disenfranchised, right? How do you get them back on track to sort of like dream again, right? To sort of like want to have their life defined by the choices they make rather than what the world gives them, right? And that's a lot of it in South Sudan. And my focus is more on like youth education, which is what we do with a nonprofit. Is like, so how do we get our young adults to schools and to actually excel in schools to define their future, to be informed, right? Like, one of the things that frustrates me with Kenya is actually that a lot of their political decisions, like especially the young people, is dictated by ethnic allegiances, and a lot of it has to do with like playing with your emotions.
Yeah.
So for me, it's one of the things I'm like, if we as a country that are like so hard right now, and we are, the path we're in is just heading there, right? And that's going to be disastrous because of how fractured our society is right now. So if we could get our young people who haven't, you know, it's like they're like now like figuring out what life is and everything. If we could get these people, like these young adults, to, you know, give them access to this high quality education where like they are educated citizens able to make decisions for themselves and not having someone decide for them, right? Get them empowered in that sense, to the extent where like everyone realizes they don't need a politician to thrive. The politician needs them to thrive, right? At that stage. So that sort of like education, you know, having a fully informed citizen, right? Of a country to drive the country forward. Because I think we have such a bright future as a country, but where we are right now, I don't know, it speaks for itself. Like, I'm not going to say much about it, but for me, that's the space I'm looking at. So how do we, you know, tap this great education and provide it for our people, you know, to build a better country and move forward, right? Like, so that like, when a call has decided, I'm going to have a podcast, the connection is not going to drop in the middle of it, right? Right? Yeah.
I don't have to postpone our thing because of the power.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, or, you know, just, so for me, that is what I'm looking at. I mean, like, it seems like out of reach, it's just like out there and whatnot. But hey, nothing is impossible, like, in my experience, in what I've,
especially
like, yeah.
Especially you, Joseph, say nothing is impossible. No, you know what I think it is, right? I always find this so interesting with podcasts, right? So I'm actually going to, like, add this to, like, because we had a conversation afterwards.
Yeah.
It becomes a sense where, like, in the beginning, when we try to have the conversation, we should have, like, started the conversation.
Ooh.
And then just kind of, like, throw that in, or it becomes a conversation, because once you finish a podcast, you have a burden lifted off your shoulder. It's like you finished the exam and now you can relax.
Exactly, yeah.
So what happens sometimes with like these shows and like these things is that you become human sometimes, and like near the end of the conversation, we start become more human. And because I feel as if sometimes like the script, and it's like when you ask me like bring me questions, you know, I never ask questions. I just kind of like, I have an idea of what I want to discuss. Tell me about yourself, your life. And then from now on, let's just boom. What do you want to talk about? So it's like, this is recording now. I want you to talk about the English study that you did.
Okay.
What was your English study that you told me about?
Wait.
The psychological impact of being like, franchise?
So I'm going to say that. This is, so we talked about it and it wasn't recorded. So It's one of the, we were talking about essentially, like, how does it feel being someone from a refugee camp setting and like as a South Sudanese going to this predominantly white institution, right? And as a freshman, my research in one of the English courses was on like, you know, how does coming from this, you know, background, you know, the psychological effects of being in those spaces, right? How does that affect your chances of success in this predominantly white institutions, right? And you will not believe it. Like, it just determines everything you do, because like you're in a class, right? And then they're probably talking about, you know, something, and then someone is going to make a comment about maybe refugees, or maybe you're black, they're going to make a comment about black people, which is very stereotypical, but they believe those are facts. So immediately you have to wear that hat of being the ambassador for your people, and you actually have to speak up. And that is why it is good to speak up for your people. It's a distraction to your learning, because it sets you into being defensive of your people, and not like you're not going to go to the space where like you feel like you're exploring, you're just like taking in information, you're just having a conversation. Now you're not being you. You have to speak. You're speaking for your people, right? And it's a default position that you don't choose to be in, right? And it's not, I don't think that's good for your learning, right? Like, but be also, yourself.
I think there's a couple of things that you add. Like,
yeah.
Like, people don't get it. It's also the psychological effect of not fitting in when you come from a place where you fit in, or the psychological effect of being part of a group and then going to a setting where you're outside the group.
Yeah.
You get it a lot, especially in PWIs. That's why you see people pushing for black. But also as Africans, it's a different angle. People don't get it, where you can go to a place and you can be around, for example, black Americans, Afro-Caribbean, West Africans, but to you, there's just as foreign as somebody outside of your community, right?
Yeah.
So when it gets to a setting where you're dealing with a unique culture, and like you said earlier, you know, your background and circumstances are different. You're at Harvard. You're dealing with people whose parents are CEOs, billionaires, politicians, and they come to you and they're like, "Oh yeah, Joseph, what do your parents do?" You know, it's like, oh, yeah, are they, you know, professors? And you're like, oh, no, I'm literally the first generation.
Yeah.
College. So the first school that my family's ever gone to is Harvard. And you see, you know, another individual who's like, oh, we're the seventh generation that gone to Harvard. And it's like,
yeah.
How did you cope with those types of feelings?
So I think growing up from a refugee camp is just like, the world decides. So what I've been fighting for is just like, I want to be in a space where like I'm deciding how I'm moving forward, not the world deciding it for me, right? So as a refugee, there's that sense of like, especially if you're given everything and you don't have to do anything for yourself, it's good, but it's disenfranchising. And it puts you in a position where like you rely on sympathy of the other people. Like, they have to sympathize with you to help you with things. So I think I realized that early on, and I was like, I don't like this. And so moving into these spaces, I just realized, like, I am not the most privileged. I don't have the privilege that, like, other people have had. I mean, like, if I'm comparing myself to other people, I have had my own privileges, and I acknowledge them. I don't mean to discount, like, other people who have had, like, you know, challenges they've had to go through. Mm-hmm. But especially at Harvard, one thing I realized is like, I'm not going to compare myself with other people. Because like, what someone did, like research with like a Nobel Prize winning professor when they were in high school, they did an internship with Coca-Cola. Before high school, they took all these college credits before high school. So if I was going to be like comparing myself with people, and then like, I am screwed. So what I realized is like, I come from a unique background, and just like other students who come from their own background, I have my own unique perspectives, which makes me, like I always say, like, no matter what happens, I'm going to be the expert of my life. And no one will tell me or no one will define it for me or convince me otherwise that they know more about me than I do. So I have something unique to offer as well as themselves. So I never looked at other students as sort of like competition so that like I can compare myself with them. But I've always looked at like, what is it that I can learn from them? What can they provide? Or like learning actually means like something you can pick up or something you can actually see and you're like, I do not like it and I don't think I want to do that. So like, and you you do your things, but you never think about like, what is it that like I don't want to do, right? Until you find someone doing something you don't want to be doing and you're like, okay, now I have to be very cognizant and conscious of so that like I do not exhibit that sort of behaviors in my interactions, right? So in those spaces and same now, like I'm going to appreciate that you had everything you had or whatever you have achieved. And for me, I'm on my own path. I am my own competition. My worst feeling is like, if I'm stuck where I was yesterday, then I'm not going to be happy with it. But if it comes from other people, your parent is coming in Tesla or like you're driving a Tesla on a Saturday night, like driving stuff to a different campus and I have to take like the city bus, bro, like enjoy it. I'm going to do my thing. Like it's, I'm not competing.
And,
yeah.
And it's kind of, you have to have a, how do I say it? It's almost knowing thyself.
Yeah.
Recognizing that your journey is yours and my journey.
Yes.
Mine. The same. Yes. Way somebody will look at you like, well, Joseph, you're at Harvard. Life is good for you, but they don't know what you go through day in and day out. They just see that's one aspect of your life. So the person, for example, who drives a Tesla might not have a good relationship with their families.
Yeah.
The person who drives a Tesla might have some traumas that we don't know about.
The
person who has a lot of wealth, who we say, this guy, man, life is good for him. He has all this money, you know.
What
other things does he face in his life? What other challenges is he facing in his life?
Yeah.
And how does he overcome those?
Those, yeah.
And I think also it's one of those things where like when you there's two like sides of the coin, right? As somebody who grew up in the West, is that when you talk to like if you come to South Sudan, you're an elite.
Oh yeah, by default.
By default of being, I think you'd be, you can count the Harvard graduate, you'd be known, this is a Harvard graduate, you know this.
Oh yeah.
And in our society, you'd be highly privileged. People view you as somebody whose life is... They'll look at you the same way you look at that person who's driving the Tesla on a Saturday, right?
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah, I see. Yeah.
But when you go back to Harvard, you're back on the bottom of the totem pole. So you're like, oh, yeah, my country, I'm, you know, I'm respected. I'm all this. I'm high. So they're like, oh, that's cool. But, like, my family here is a billionaire family. Oh, my his net worth is $5 billion. Okay. South Sudan's economy is not even $5 billion. Like, there's some people who at your university whose family's net worth is more than the economy of your country. Right? And that's the one, it's hard to fathom that. So it becomes like a double-edged sword where, in one aspect, you lose and you feel emotionally drained dealing with your people because they look at you from position of privilege.
Well,
like I'm sure there's people who think that you're rich because you went to Harvard. That's it. They don't know how things work. Like this guy has to be living good. He went to Harvard. But when you say, oh, you know, I'm trying to like hustle, do things on the side. No. And then you go and day in and day out, you're reminded that you're at the bottom of the totem pole.
Yeah. You're
reminded that you are somebody who your circumstances are not the circumstances of your classmates. It's quite interesting. You get what I'm trying to say? And it's just, it's so
I see
it's
you.
Like two worlds.
I see you. Yeah.
And it's, what could be the psychological impacts of that?
So I have a lot of personal stories because these are some of the things like I've probably thought about or like talked about with people before. I think the problem is we look at something and then we just place someone in that bucket and think that's what they are. But whatever that is in that bucket is just a drip. It's just like a portion of what that person is. To put it into simpler terms, like we need to humanize every person's story. We need to humanize people. That means like even if we have like preconceived notions about people, we actually need to listen to them and like find out, you know, how they are and like, you know, as a person, right? And when I'm saying that, it's like, so for me, I uploaded me doing some presentation and the caption was nothing related to the presentation. But in the presentation, there was a photo of me like doing brick playing, right? And that was after I got into Harvard, right? So I went to the camp and there was like this lady, she needed help with like putting their house together and you have to make mud bricks. So I went joining and help and everything. And everybody was like, why would you do that? Like, stop, right? Like you said, like, there's like the status people put you in. So I uploaded that and people couldn't believe that I did it. And I'm like, what is so difficult about it, right? So why am I saying that? It's just me being in the mud, like up to like the thighs and my, you know, hands and everything. It's all in mud and we're making those breaks and just like, it's backbreaking, but I'm enjoying it. I'm doing it a service for the people. I'm sort of like doing it with guys and I'm like getting to know them, getting to talk to them and stuff, you know, find out like how they, you know, with life and everything. So I'm enjoying it. It's in the moment and we took pictures and I never uploaded it until like I had to do this presentation about the camp because I needed people to understand like it's like you make your own houses from the mud and stuff. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing up this story is like whenever I say I went to Harvard, people are no longer sort of like interested in talking about like the person I am, the things I do, the things I aspire to do, and my relationship with other people. But all my conversation is going to be centered around me going to Harvard and the assumption like I'm this super smart, like genius and everything, right? And I'm like, I think it's the other way around. Harvard shapes part of my experience, like especially with like
more to you.
There's more to me. Harvard is just one of them. It's not like there's
part of your life.
An aspect of my life, exactly. Like there is, if you find people talking about Harvard, I can speak to Harvard experience, right? Like I can speak to it, but that's not me. And it's the same way. So when these people are, like you said before, when these people are driving Teslas, right? You look at them, it's a Tesla. Oh my God, they're rich and stubborn and everything. And you just think, and that's where you put them. But, and what that does is by default, like if I hadn't realized that, and if I fall into that trap, it would be like, now that I'm speaking with you, I would be speaking as a Harvard graduate, not duty. What does that do? I have to say what I would assume a Harvard graduate would say.
So immediately you're
So that dehumanizes me. It dehumanizes
in the opposite way, and people don't realize that because you can
dehumanize. They don't realize it
up and dehumanize down because if I dehumanize you as just quote unquote this elite Ivy League person, I've taken away from your personality. Instead of saying
exactly,
for example, earlier in the conversation, I'm like, "Tell me about your experience being a refugee." People overlook that because like, oh, he went through a lot, but guess what? He went to Harvard at least. It's not a medicine to alleviate any challenge you face in your life. You know what I mean? And that's how sometimes, and I feel as if sometimes like, I read an article about, I don't know if you know Nassim Taleb. He's one of my favorite authors. He's written like Anti-Fragile, Black Swan.
I don't. I think a friend mentioned, but I haven't. So okay, I need to make a note.
He says such something so interesting, and like I remember, he said some schools in some places have become a commodity as opposed to going there for learning. He's like, Harvard and Yale are like having a Lamborghini now.
It's
you do just to say you have it.
Yeah.
It's the same thing you have, for example, people in instance, they'll go to the best schools to be known as, I went to this school, and their whole argument is, I went to this school. And
I mean, some people make it their personality, right? Because like,
but
other than that, they have nothing else to provide. You dehumanize
yourself.
Yeah.
More to just be relegated to where you went to school. Where
I'm just a hard what that graduate. Makes is like, you and live up to the expectations.
You lived up, but not even expectation, you lose yourself.
Like, exactly.
Have you seen The Boondocks?
No. I think I saw it once, but I wasn't very interested in it. So I was just like,
okay, I like The Boondocks. I mean, it's one of my favorite cartoons. So there's an episode in The Boondocks. So for those of you guys listening, The Boondocks is this satirical cartoon. So the Boondocks, there's an episode where there's like they're paired to BET and the executive went to Harvard. So and every time the executive is challenged, he's like, did you go to Harvard? And so he makes all these stupid executive mistakes.
Yeah.
Justified because he went to Harvard. So
went to Harvard, yeah.
It's like you say that, like, and I like the point you made. It's like, I don't want people to treat me like a Harvard graduate, treat me like Joseph or Duty.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. That's it.
Nothing more to it. Like,
but just, do you feel like, in a way, some people do dehumanize you?
Intentionally or not?
But because, once again, dehumanization is unintentional. I mean, in some instances, yeah. It's kind of like when family members believe that because you're in America, you have money, you should send them. They dehumanize you and they relegate you to just a source of revenue. So, and then what happens is the relationship becomes predicated on a transaction and predicated on what you do for me. You know how that mindset that our people have.
That's so true. Not,
and
like,
you're
what
like,
you said,
no, you guys
true.
Don't know what I'm going through. Like, I remember when I was in America, I was in college, man. I was working as a dishwasher. Let me tell you, man, I was working odd jobs. I used to work at a call center. But I get calls from people in Africa, man, send me money, send me $500. I'm like, $500? My rent is $300. And you don't rent in college. You rent a small, you rent a room in an apartment and share a bathroom. You get what I mean? And it's just like, you guys don't know. And half the time I'm at the library. But do you feel like sometimes people do dehumanize you unintentionally?
Oh, all the time. All the time from a lot of angles. Like at Harvard, I realized like it's transactional. Like, you relate with people based on what they can give you. And if you feel like you're the one giving, it's no longer like, just cut it. You know, like, it's either they're giving you and you're giving to them, or they're the ones giving to you. That's how you maintain that relationship. But it's also been the same. Like, we're losing the sense of family and community, especially with that Jing, like, sort of like Jing, and by an extent, South Sudanese. Is like, what I find is like, someone has their problem, right? And they call you. They don't even ask, like, how are you? Like, they don't even know if your AC is working or if you actually have an AC. They don't even know if your heater is working, right? They don't even know where you sleep, right? They don't even know if you share a bathroom with someone. They don't even know the work you do. But they're like, send me this. And if you don't, like, you're not related. It's like that. Like, things like that, right? And so they overlook the fact that you may be having problems and struggling. And as a family, you should know, like, how your colleague, like, how your family member is doing, and find out, like, are they in a position to help you or not, and sort of, like, understand them. Unfortunately enough, like, I have, especially my immediate family members, they sort of, like, understand that because I'm very vocal when I'm speaking to them, and I sort of, like, try to explain. But not everyone is getting it. And so sometimes, yeah.
And do you sense they become more transactional? Because, like,
it's very transactional because, like,
and what's so crazy about these cultured people, like these people who are supposed to espouse some of our traditional cultural values, have become so fixated on transaction.
On transactions, exactly.
And it's like, then you're like, oh, you don't pick up your phone because I know what you want to call me about.
What you want to call me about, exactly.
And
like,
I don't
the only time you ever call me, the only time you ever call me, it's like you want something. But it's like, sometimes I just want to call you to find out how you're doing, how your kids are doing. Or maybe I just want to know something about what's going on at home. Or maybe like the traditions, or like just have those conversations, right? But it's like, I'm afraid to call you because you are going to tell me you have this problem and you want me to help you with what I don't have, which speaks like I can internalize it. And that sort of like speaks more to my inadequacies because like it's a process. I'm building something. I'm not going to have it in a day. Hopefully someday I'm going to have it. But if you call when I don't have it, it makes me feel like I am failing, but I am not. So instead of like
and
coming to hit me back,
like
I will avoid it.
You avoid it, but then also another thing people don't get. Do you remember when you had nothing and those people never cared about you?
Bro.
Do you feel like that? Like,
yes.
Why is it now when I'm doing well, you see me here, you want to claim me? But before, when I was struggling, you didn't.
They weren't
give a
there.
Damn.
They didn't give us. They didn't. Sorry, my bad. The language.
No.
But
hey, man, I said so. We're all filtered.
Yeah.
All right, guys. This extra clips, and this is our conversation.
Yeah, we did the podcast and we were like, I think like we had a conversation. It was like it's just becoming more interesting. So like,
if you listen to this, we just added in, and then you're gonna listen to the ending. He's gonna talk about his message to South Sudanese, and we're gonna close it. But we after the podcast, we just had a good. You know what's so interesting, guys? He's the one who told me that my podcasts are too long. So when I'm interviewing him, I don't want it to be too long. I'm like, this guy told me that my podcast, he's like, you know, you should make it shorter. So I'm like, okay, you know what? This is the one who, all of a sudden, I'm like, you know what? This is the person that I should have gave him a 2-hour Joe Rogan podcast. Because I need to find that Twitter. I literally need it.
I mean, we did the 45 minutes and then we were like,
he's like, you know what?
Let's talk person to person. Let's record it.
You should keep it, you know, personal. I'm like, what is this guy? What do you mean personal? I mean, keep it short. Here you are telling me that. And then after, so guys, okay, this is a funny thing. You guys, so if you listen to this, so we finished the podcast and I'm really trying to make it 45 minutes. So I'm like trying to like stop him. We literally finished the podcast. I stopped recording and like, we just start chatting. We say goodbye like 5 times. Okay, we'll see you later. Then something comes. Oh, see you later. And then, by the way, this. So like, I'm like, let's just record. Because for 30 minutes, he's like, okay, I'll see you. We gave, let's chat. Let's be in contact. You know, well, I'll let you know when I'm in the States or all this. And then just the conversation kept. So I'm like, you know what? Let's just record. I'll find a way. And guys, he's the one who told me that my episode were long. So now if this episode is long, he's the one that has to be blamed. It's not me.
I am sorry.
So if this
I'm so
is
sorry.
70 an hour and a half is him, man. Because I try to make it 40.
I take the blame.
So self-conscious. This is so interesting. Like, you know, podcasts are always raw. But you see how it is.
I mean, like, you know, Twitter spaces can go for like hours and hours, right? Because like you can pop in and out. But with podcasts, it's just like, I don't have that time. Like, I could be in a car for maybe like 20 minutes and I listen to like 20 minutes of it. Or maybe, but just having like, so when I listened to your first podcast, right? I was like, oh my days, this is the podcast I've been looking for. Cause what are my people doing out there? And I was like, but do I have like an hour and 15 minutes like every week? No, I don't.
But now
probably.
You, but also you can break it down, but also like, it's not all the time you absorb it, but also like, for example, in our podcast, people can come to the good parts. In the beginning, they can skim over it. Like, you can do this. The idea is to put out the content. Then when you get the chance, you can sit down, let's say, listen
for
30 minutes today, 30 minutes tomorrow.
30 minutes.
So, you see, listeners, this is the guy. We had to re-record because of this guy telling me that these things are too long. And then when we have literally, we have the best conversations after the podcast because I'm literally trying to like, man, this guy, he probably doesn't want like, he's not going to be on here for an hour. He probably has to go. And I'm just like, as soon as we hit like 45 minutes, I'm like, okay, let me wind it down. But all in all, guys, you got raw conversation today. You got a great conversation.
Wait. I'll call it to my defense. To my defense, though, we did the podcast. We did the time as it was. But I think person to person, there's like a lot of like conversations that, and there's still more we can talk about. We can go on and on about our perspectives about things.
Yeah.
It could be like things I have talked about before or I haven't talked about, and then you just sort of like bring them up and like we share all this. And I think it's the beauty of human conversations, like human relationships, is that like every time, even though you are twins and you've lived together, you perceive things differently. And when you talk about them, like going back to college, I'm sorry, I talk about college a lot, but going back to college, you actually get a paper and you read it and you have your takeaways and somebody else does, and you think you've gotten it all. But then when you are, you know, sharing views or perspectives about how you felt or like how you understood the readings, and like someone brings it out and then it clicks that it actually was part of the reading, and you're like, how did I miss it? Right. But you appreciate that they bring it out, and that's the reason why you have that conversation. And going back, it's why, like, it's beautiful. Like, human relationships are beautiful because, like, you don't know how they perceived it and until you talk with them. But even though you're talking
to
them,
and it happens so naturally. But you know what I like, what I'm going to do moving forward?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, really just going to focus on the human conversation because it's so natural. Because, like,
like
it's so crazy. Like, I told you, you're the first person who's like, okay, send me questions. I'm like, okay. I'm like, this guy. Because you want to be really delicate with your guest. I'm like, okay, maybe he's one of those people that really wants the question. But I was going to go in there, like, talk. But now what I'm going to do moving forward is that I'm literally just going to do the introduction, tell us what you want to tell us about your life.
Yeah.
Talking about it. Hey, tell me more. Get deeper. Like, stuff like, how does it impact you being at Harvard? How you feel like Harvard, it dehumanizes you? Who says that? Who says that Harvard, I feel dehumanized because people look at me as a Harvard instead of me? Those are things that, like, and that's what I think the beauty, like we said this earlier, the beauty of podcasts is that people like to hear people talking about deep stuff. Like this conversation, people are going to be listening to it and they're going to be excited. Like I can already see it because they're going to be like, man, it's like, now I know, like, I think I'm going to have to go back and like find, I'm going to have to squeeze this in. I'm going to have to squeeze this in.
Like, you're the creator.
It literally, I have to, like, I'll find it. I think what I'll do, I'll just put it here at the end and then just have the introduction go in there. And I throw, like, music. That's what I'm going to do, by the way. Good idea. I'll find some cover music. Go
in there. Yeah, say, you can do that. You can do that. There, so. That's what I bring on the table as a former digital media consultant.
Yeah. By the way, I learned today that you can do
royalty-free music.
Is it royalty-free?
Royalty-free music,
So, like, even here.
Yeah, so the other thing I've said, I think people don't know about this, but you don't talk about yourself a lot in the podcast, but you said you did, like, the Bachelor's of Arts in Political Science, right? At So Iowa State University. Do not let people define you, or do not be defined by your major, where you went to school, the color of your skin, where you live, what you do. You are more than that. Yeah, you weigh more than that. You're more than what people think you are. And when people, like, here's the problem. When people tell you you're smart, when people tell you, it's a good compliment. Like, I was shopping. I went grocery shopping and then, like, I was in the line and everything. I was like, why isn't this line going and stuff? And then, like, this random lady just walked up to me. She's white. Not to be prejudiced, but she walked up to me and she's like, oh my God, like, you're such a beautiful man. Like, and she likes that. So what that sent me into was like, I do not know what is happening. I zoned out. Good enough for me. She just left. I was in the queue, like, trying to just go pay my stuff and go, right? And the reason I bring that is like, when someone tells you you are this, remember, it's not the whole of you. It's a part of you. So do not be conditioned to think you are that thing and that thing alone. It's just like an aspect of you. Could be true, could not be true, whatever people say to flatter you or whatever. I don't care. Like, so it goes back to our conversation of like humanizing people. Like, it's Harvard or whatever, they're gonna tell you that, and they're impressed, and they will keep talking on and on. Like, it's okay.
And then
keep
it's like, talking about say, it. Oh, that's cool. You went to this school, or you did that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, that's interesting. I mean,
you're more than
I've gotten that. Like, you're right. Don't talk about me. I expect my viewers to know me. I mean, I went to the U.S. young.
Wait, how tall are you?
I'm 6'3".
6'3". In America, that's tall as. Like, tall as it gets, right?
Yeah, but my family, I'm short.
In your family, you're short, but people out there don't know that. So in America, like, I would imagine, like, on,
how tall are
like,
you?
I'm like 6'4", 6'5", which is like about 6'5", but like, yeah, whatever, 6'4", 6'5".
Do you play basketball? But
I don't. I never knew about playing basketball until, like, I've never played basketball, actually. Yeah, but people think I play basketball. That's like, a lot of experiences with people assuming I am an NBA star, or like I play like in some league and they want to get my autographs.
Wait a second. They think you're an NBA star because you're tall. You're 6'4".
Yeah, I mean, like, if you're getting someone who's like 5'7", like, you're way taller than them. I mean, like,
America, somebody's like the height of somebody, the average height is like, what is it?
Like, I don't have that stat, so no, 5'10 might be, it's actually 5'6".
5'9" for me.
5'6" for height. 5'6" for male and 5'2" for female. I don't know if I'm gonna trust the statistics I'm looking at. But oh, it's 5'9", yeah. 5'9".
Okay, let's be honest. 5'9". You're a science guy. Average, and we need to talk about average. Okay, man, we have a lot. Let's do the median height, not the average, because the average can be skewed by the higher
intervals.
And those, because the average of 100 and 0 is 50, right?
Yeah.
So if you take 5, 6 numbers, that's why you look at the median. That's why you say, what is a median? So if you group it from 0 to, you know, infinity, what is the middle number? Because average is going to be skewed by...
See, the problem with that is like, you have more people on the shorter end. Uh-huh. Right? Yes, because like, so right now, China alone and India, they have what, like, more than 2 billion? What's the average height?
That's more. That's like 2.5 billion.
Yeah, more than that. But what's the average height?
The world is 8 billion. That right there is like 30% of the world.
Yeah, like water or something. Yeah, but
I feel like people don't see how crazy that is. Like those two countries account for almost 30% of the world's population.
Yeah,
and if you throw in the Asian Peninsula, that's like 60% of the world.
And then there comes in the South Americans. Like they're not as tall. It's very stereotypical, but like they're not as tall.
But that's
like,
why when you say, "Oh, the average height of the Dank or the Nuer, the Nilotics,"
oh,
it's like we're all tall.
We're all tall.
Because you have people who are 7'2", and then you have people short. People who are 6 foot. So if you have people who are the height, your tallest person, let's say our tallest person, Manute Bol, you know, God rest his soul, 7'7". 7'7" is.
I think there are people taller than him, though.
There's even people saying taller than him. Then there's people who are like 7'2", 7'3", 7'1". I mean, look at those guys of Bol Bol, Win Yin, and all these different basketball players. I'm like, bro, you guys are tall. You see them, I'm like, you're tall.
You're tall, yeah.
So it's like 7'7". The median height, I can say, is probably 6'3", 6'4".
Yeah.
My family, they say I'm short. My cousins, though, they say you're short.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I'm like, what do you mean I'm short?
You and I is like average. Actually, like,
you're a giant. So,
oh, my, yeah. I mean, like, I take that, yeah. I've been walking down the street and everyone is just like below, like, you know, like it's a few, one or two. But yeah, that's crazy.
Gosh, let me stop recording this.
How did we even get
possible? You went from a refugee camp to Harvard. I mean, so you are truly an inspiration. So we're going to wind up here, Joseph. But I want to ask you, what is one message you have to young South Sudanese? Because when people see your story, when we share this, they're going to be inspired. Somebody listening to this right now is going to be like, wow. I mean, they're going to hear that you repeated P1. You didn't get into the school you wanted to get into, which was Stanford. You faced challenges. You're a human being, but you overcame them. What is your final message to young South Sudanese, and what is a message that you want to drill in their head?
That's a good question. And I mean, to everyone listening, like, my mentality has always been like, I'm gonna try and go out and find information as possible and not be prejudiced to just take everything as it is. Just like, okay, this is the information I'm gonna. Now I'm gonna like dig into it and see like how does that shape my values, or like how I see things, or like how I'm gonna make a decision. So I'm hesitant to sort of like tell people do this or do that. But what I can say is there's a lot of opportunities out there. And there's a lot of opportunities, and these opportunities can shape you to be the person who can be the agent of change for your people, right? It can shape you to also be the agent of distraction, right? So in a world with like so many things in it, I think it has to begin with you taking the initiative. If you want to say like just getting a college degree or maybe start a business, like the other podcast he had, like he's a great example of what is out there. Like it has to start with you. You're not gonna be waiting like my dad, my mom, my brother, my uncle. No, like they can give you everything you need, but if you haven't decided that's what you want, you're not going to get it. So I think in Swahili, they say like kujituma, right? Like you have to sit down and just be like, I want to do this. I'm going to do it. And then you go out there and go get it. And let no one tell you you cannot achieve it. No, it might take long. It might take forever. But eventually, if your eyes are set to go get it, you're going to go get it, right? So every day, I think like it's like this self-affirmation thing. So like, I am enough. You know, I have what it takes. I know it's going to take a lot to get what I want. But guess what? I'm going to do what it takes to get it done, right? So I think it starts with like just being like, I'm going to do it, and you go for it. So out there, go for whatever.
Go for it.
Go for it. Yes, go for it. Exactly.
I don't care how long it takes. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the words of advice from a refugee turned Harvard graduate, turned leader, and now he's giving back to his people. He's going back to those same people and trying to help them get opportunities. He's lifting up the ladder. He went up on the ladder, and he's bringing the ladder back down for people. This is what we love to see. This is what we love to hear about. These are the South Sudanese that give us hope. As always, thank you for joining us on South Sudan the World. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Look up Mr. Joseph. I'll share his information on in the description, his Twitter, his LinkedIn, and I'll share this on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. You can find this on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Once again, don't give up and do your best. Thank you so much.
You'll get it. Thanks for hosting me.